We will never choose anyone. We will not hurt each other or anyone else. I cannot be more clear on that. We cannot be more clear. So that means you're going to let us go, and then you're going to leave, and then... Leonard claps his hands once, as loud as a slamming door. Okay, you need to listen to this part too. I've been shown exactly what will happen if you choose not to make a sacrifice. We've all been shown. He spreads his arms out wide across the cabin. Adrian bites the back of her knuckles, shrinks away from Eric and off into the kitchen. She circles around her weapon. I've been made to watch the end, over and over, since last Monday. It started as a nightmare, and whenever I closed my eyes, the end was there. And as we got closer to this day, the vision started happening when I was awake. I couldn't escape it. I didn't want to believe it. I thought there might be something wrong with me. But the visions were so strong and so specific, so real. Leonard pauses and wipes his face. Sabrina, Adrian, and Redmond all saw the same things, too. They saw the exact same things I was seeing. And we were led to each other, and we were led here. I don't think you're getting that we don't want to be here, don't want any of this to happen. But we have no choice. The choice is yours. Sabrina stands behind Leonard with her weapon in her hands. Andrew didn't see when she retrieved it. He tries to get his breathing under control. He cannot let fear totally shut him down. His stiff fingers renew their frantic waving at Wen, and stretching toward the knots out of reach. Andrew considers arching his back and pushing off with the balls of his feet until he flips himself and the chair backward to crash to the floor. Maybe the fall would somehow loosen his restraints. The longest of shots, but it might be his only chance. Andrew shouts to be heard over Leonard. The shouting doesn't stop Leonard from speaking. So you had an apocalyptic nightmare. So what? We've all had them. First, the cities will drown. No one living in cities will know it's coming. That doesn't mean anything. You know that. You have to know that. The ocean will swell and rise up into a great fist and pound all the buildings and people into the sand and then drag everything out to sea. There is something wrong with you, all of you, if you believe this. Then, a terrible plague will descend, and people will writhe with fever, and mucus will fill their lungs. This is psychotic, delusional. Did you try to get help? Let us go, and we'll get you help. The skies will fall and crash to the earth like pieces of glass, and then the final, everlasting darkness will descend over humanity and all the species of the earth. You need help! This is fucking insane, all of this. This is going to happen, and we've been shown that only your sacrifice can stop it. Shown by who? By what? Are you going to answer that? Leonard bows his head and doesn't say anything. Neither does Sabrina, Redmond, or Adrian. That we can talk them out of this window is closed, if it ever was open. Eric says, come on, talk to us. Tell us more about what you were shown. Who gave you the nightmares? Who told you about us? It doesn't make sense. Think about it for a second. Leonard remains motionless. Sabrina and Redmond briefly make eye contact and then look away, actively and obviously looking anywhere else in the cabin but at each other. Adrian tightens her circle around her weapon. The only sound Andrew hears in the madness of silence is his own labored breathing. Leonard lifts his head and says, "The choice has been made." Redmond and Sabrina walk in front of Leonard, holding their weapons. They step in time, as trained soldiers might. Redmond twists his neck from side to side, the obnoxious, tough guy equivalent of cracking knuckles. Sabrina closes her eyes, inhales, and then adjusts her grip on the wooden staff, the strange, curly-cued shovel head held like a torch in the darkness. Eric says,
"Wait, stop. You don't have to do this."
He strains and struggles in his chair, but there isn't much strength behind his efforts.
"Hey, you don't need those things. You said you couldn't hurt us."
Andrew strains to pull his legs free, to peel his arms apart. They feel looser in his restraints, but not close to free. He yells names and no and stop, and he vibrates in his seat. He pushes up onto his toes, and the tipping point is close, one twitchy push-off, and he'll fall over backward. From behind him, Adrian puts a hand on his shoulder and anchors him and the chair flush to the floor without any struggle at all. One hand, and that's all the pressure needed to keep him pinned to where he is, no matter how much thrashing he does. He throws his head back, trying to hit her, but he doesn't make contact. Her hand leaves his shoulder, and Wen screams, "Leave me alone!" Andrew yells for Wen, and twists to see where Adrian went, to see what she's doing. Legs suddenly appear in front of Andrew's face, kicking and waving, as though attempting to swim up from a great depth. Adrian is lowering his daughter onto his lap.
"Don't touch her. Let her go!"
Wen twists free and hugs Andrew tightly around the neck. Her cheek is hot and wet against his. He says her name repeatedly and whispers into her ear that she has to leave, to run, to push the screen slider out and run onto the deck and run and run. Redmond loudly bangs the sledgehammer end of his double-ended staff on the floor. Then he gives Leonard the weapon without an exchange of words. Their movements are choreographed, ritualized. Leonard flips the ends of the staff so that the arrangement of shovel and trowel blades is pointed at the floor. Redmond scratches the back of his head and fidgets with his empty hands. He kneels on the hardwood floor, making a triangle with Eric and Andrew. He says,
"Oh, fuck. Okay, come on, come on. Here we go."
And claps his hands, wipes his face, laughs once, shakes his head, and grunts like a weightlifter gearing up for an inhuman feat of strength. Andrew isn't whispering anymore.
"Run, Wen, run!"
Wen shakes her head and says, "I can't." Redmond abruptly quits his routine, stops moving, and stares at Andrew with his head tilted. Andrew maneuvers his face around Wen's head so he can see this, whatever it is. Redmond's face has drained of color, and sweat darkens his receding hairline. He licks his cracked, bleeding lips and blinks rapidly. He's scared, and it makes him look younger. He could be one of Andrew's students, hundreds or thousands of miles from home, in his office to plead for an extension on a paper, or for a better grade in the class to ensure he doesn't lose his performance-based grant money. Redmond reaches into the front pocket of his jeans and pulls out something white. It practically glows as he unfolds it in front of his red shirt. Larger than the dressing on the back of Eric's head, it appears to be a swatch of thin cloth, ribbed or waffled like thermal underwear. He lifts it high over his head, stretching and extending his arms as far up as they will go. Redmond winks at Andrew and grins, the kind that makes any face ugly. Andrew has been the recipient of this version of the smug, judgmental, nonverbal "fuck you" countless times, and it nags at him that perhaps he's seen this smile on this particular face before today. Eric says,
"Please, God, just let us go. Let us go."
In a continuous loop. Wen has stopped crying.
"What is that? What is he doing?"
Andrew tells her not to watch. Redmond pulls and stretches the material over his head, face, and halfway down his neck. It's form-fitting, like a sock over a foot. The lump of his nose protrudes below his prominent brow, and from between the uncanny valleys of his concave eye sockets. A star of red blooms in the cloth over his split lip. He drops his arms to his sides. The sun breaks through the clouds, a promise that will one day be broken, and shines into the cabin via the deck, illuminating this reluctant summit. The players are momentarily as still as stone obelisks in their ancient shadows. Although Redmond's face is concealed within the blank white mask, Andrew feels the man's stare. And like all stares, it accrues mass with passing time. Then, finally, there are two words. Thank you. Eric. Eric's litany of please gods cuts out, and he shrinks from the return of the sun like a vampire. His head is one of the old hot water radiators from their condo, and it hisses with pain. Redmond, in the supplicant's eternal pose, awash in golden light, is transformed. The red of his shirt is no longer confined to the cloth and slicks into the air like oil in water. Red mists beyond the boundary of Redmond, forming an aura as amorphous as a storm. There's a darker spot of red clinging stubbornly to his white mask, a different kind of promise. All will be red eventually. Redmond says, "Thank you." Sabrina, Leonard, and Adrian drift into the center of the cabin, creeping delicately, hunters stalking elusive, skittish prey. They form a half-circle around Redmond, their gnarly, improvised staffs aloft. Something shimmers in the nowhere between Redmond and the doorway to the deck. Like heat waves on summer-baked pavement, the shimmer is whiter and brighter than the surrounding solar light. Eric blinks, and the strange refraction realigns, finds a focus, coalesces into a shape, a form. And for the briefest of moments, there is an unmistakable contour of a head and shoulders, an outline of another person, a fourth, or another fourth, joining the semicircle encompassing Redmond. Leonard and Adrian swap positions. They walk between Redmond and the deck, passing through that nowhere space, eclipsing the vision, wiping it out. It's gone, whatever it is, made of empty space and the whitest light. Eric does not think he saw another person coming in from outside, some secret member of their group, hiding and waiting until the right time to enter the cabin. The vision's near instant appearance and disappearance only amplifies the wrongness and unearthliness, filling Eric's head with the snow and crackle of a lost signal static. He realizes what he saw is most certainly the result of his injury and misfiring synapses. Still, he's afraid to inspect too closely the memory of the experience. More than an instinctual fear of the inexplicable that cannot be verbalized, it's the bone-deep dread of discovery. What if the shimmer and its light did not come from his scrambled brain and was not a trick of the sun? That question is followed by another that bubbles up and does not present in his typical inner voice or manner. An ever-evolving mental life is impossible to fully detail, even by the owner, and one generally goes from day to day unquestioning one's own being or consciousness, with absolute faith in this is who I am and this is how I think. The follow-up question does not fit within Eric's secret mental code, does not use the unique parts of speech of his interior language. It is not of him. To Eric's horror, the question feels like an intrusion from a different mind, or a terrifying answer to an unspoken prayer. What if the shimmer's light came from the colder spaces of the infinite sky? When? Nothing that has happened to this point is as scary or creepy as the kneeling and masked Redmond. The outline and contours of his hidden face fill her with the same mix of fascination and dread she felt when she stared at the human skull that was in her classroom. What if the mask is Redmond's new skin, and underneath, there is only the whiter white of bone? She imagines his face and head changing shape while hidden away, and then Leonard ripping off the mask like a magician to reveal a grotesque, ravenous monster, the kind so terrible and ugly that just looking at it will kill you. Redmond says,
"Thank you."
His puppet mouth opens and closes out of rhythm with the words, an amateur attempt at ventriloquism. The cloth through which he speaks is thin, but his voice sounds garbled, modulated. He doesn't sound like he does. Wen covers her ears because she does not want to hear anything else he might say. Adrian appears from behind Andrew's chair, floating like a patient ghost, and flanks Redmond's left side. The bramble of raking claws at the end of Adrian's weapon passes over her and Andrew's heads, close enough so Wen can count the tangles of claws and their individual sharpened points plaqued with rust and dirt. Adrian's face is blank. Her facial muscles are rigid scaffolding for her skin. Leonard stands behind Redmond, as stoic and still as a brick wall. Wen stares at Leonard, wanting and waiting for him to look at her. Despite everything, she hopes Leonard will show himself to be a good person, the person she thought he was when they were out in the front yard together. She considers waving at him, but decides against trying to get his attention. He has the same blank robot face Adrian has. Sabrina has the robot face, too. She drifts within arm's reach of Eric and settles to Redmond's right. Wen darts her eyes around the room, memorizing everyone's position, where they stand, and how they hold their staffs. She turns her head and twists her torso, almost falling off Andrew's lap. Poor Daddy Eric is alone. He alternates between being wide-eyed and squeezing his eyelids shut, exaggerated blinks like he has something stuck in his eyes and it won't go away. It appears he's looking above Redmond, not at him, and into the kitchen or out toward the deck. Wen looks out there too, and then past the deck to the shimmering blue lake, which is a million miles away. Wen sinks deeper into Daddy Andrew's lap, and deeper inside herself. Should she go to Daddy Eric? Maybe walking over and simply kissing the back of his head will make him better. Then she'll talk to him and no one else, shake him if she has to, and tell him she can help if he would just tell her what to do. What are they going to do? Maybe she should run, like Daddy Andrew said. Sprint through the room, dodge the turned-over furniture like a mouse through high grass, then onto the deck and outside and away. She can run fast. Her dads tell her that she is fast, so fast, all the time. And they tell her she is shifty. She knows their races are fixed for her to win. But when outlasting the catchers in their catch-me-if-you-can games, until Eric and or Andrew are bent over, hands on knees gasping for air, is legitimate. She is shifty. Wen loves that word. It means hard to catch. It means even better than fast. It's a smart fast. Leonard and Adrian exchange positions. Adrian is stationed in front of the couch and directly behind Redmond. Leonard is now closer to the kitchen and parked to Redmond's left. The room is bright and quiet, but for Andrew's heavy breathing. Wen rocks and tilts side to side with his expanding and then collapsing chest. She knows she'd make it out of the cabin without getting caught if she was to run. But where would she run to? She doesn't want to accidentally get lost on the dirt roads that fork and branch away leading to nowhere, or to worse places than here. And what if she has to ditch the road for the thick woods surrounding the cabin for miles and miles? Her dads were explicit in saying she could not go into these woods by herself under any circumstances, because they might never find her again. She blurts out, "Go away, all of you, and take off the mask and stop trying to scare us." No one responds. None of the four, including the masked Redmond, look at her. Wen is terrified, but she puts on her own mask, an angry face, the angriest one she has, so that hers is not as blank and lifeless as the four others' faces. She shifts her hips and slides her left leg off Andrew's lap. Her foot hovers a few inches above the floor as a brief test. No one moves to grab her. No one moves at all. She slides down farther until the toe of her sneaker kisses the hard wood. She waits. If no one notices, if no one says anything, she is going to run between Redmond and Leonard and then onto the deck. In her head, she is down the back stairs and running on the dirt road already, with long and shifty strides. In one motion, Adrian lunges forward and swings her weapon. The raking claws whistle through the air. Andrew. Even as Leonard and Adrian exchange positions in the common room, Andrew remains focused on and obsessed with Redmond. Why is he so familiar? And why is he wearing that freak show of a mask? And what can he see through it? And why did he say thank you? And why did he say it the way he said it? Low, guttural, breathless, not angry, but groveling and as fervent as an ecstatic. Wen says, "Go away, all of you, and take off the mask and stop trying to scare us." She no longer has her arms wrapped around Andrew's neck, and she is not burrowed into his chest. Her weight is unbalanced on his lap. He tempers his efforts at pulling his legs and hands free from the ropes and chair, for fear he'll jostle her, and she'll fall awkwardly to the floor and get hurt. She slowly leaks off his lap, to his left, and there's nothing he can do to readjust her position. He's about to say her name, to jolt her into readjusting herself and staying put, when it occurs to him that her sliding off is purposeful, and perhaps she's getting ready to make a run for it, like he told her to. She methodically stretches toward the floor with one leg, and he's now convinced she's considering a mad dash outside the cabin and beyond. He silently pleads with her to go now, and it's all he can do not to say go out loud. She might not get another chance. If she does run, then one or two of them will go after her, and that would buy him some time to work on loosening his restraints. Careful to not give away inadvertently an escape route by staring it down, Andrew surveys potential paths through the common room and possible roadblocks to the deck for Wen. Andrew hears the movement first, a quick shuffle of feet coming from Redmond's direction. Andrew assumes the noise is Redmond scrambling onto his feet, but he has not moved. Redmond is still kneeling on the floor, his spine straight and masked head held high. Then there's a loud stomp on the floor behind Redmond. Adrian's right foot is forward, planted only inches behind Redmond's feet. Her hips pivot, and she swings her staff. The sphere of raking claws comets through the air, and the rusted metal crashes into the right side of Redmond's face. He sways with the impact, but he recovers and straightens again, and remains kneeling and upright. A slight but visible shiver ripples throughout his body. A high-pitched animal whimper escapes from under his mask. At the same time as the impact of the blow, Eric exhales a loud grunt, as though he is the one who is struck. Wen completes her slide off his lap and is standing next to Andrew and the chair. She turns so she is facing the front door and wraps her arms around Andrew's neck again. She doesn't scream or cry. Her mouth is next to his ear, and her breathing is off rhythm, exhaling too soon after a sharp inhale, and then too long a pause between breaths. And after the pause, air rushes out like she's deflating. Raking claw tips are caught, stuck in Redmond's mask and face. Adrian pulls on the handle of her weapon as though working an axe out from a deep gash in a tree. The white mask stretches, stubbornly hooked on one of the claws. The right side of Redmond's head turns as bright red as his shirt. From Redmond's right, Sabrina crow hops forward and swings her staff in a horizontal arc, the tapered and oddly curled shovel blade held sideways so as to be more blade-like. She's close enough to Andrew that he feels the whoosh of parting air. The thin edge of metal mashes into the front of Redmond's face, in the area of his nose and mouth, and there's a clang and scraping noise. Redmond collapses onto his side and loosens a wail, a liquid scream. Adrian and Sabrina shower blow after blow upon Redmond. The abstract metal shapes at the ends of their handles rise and then strike downward like greedy bird heads. The women grunt with each swing and retrieval of their weapons. The metal configurations of the weapons chime and reverberate with contact, singing joyfully now that they are finally being used as their retrofitters intended. There are also hollow thuds and other sounds that are wet and wooden. Redmond's guttural screams and squeals weaken and become less recognizably human. Wen's shallow, ragged breathing are Andrew's own breaths, if he is in fact breathing at all. Redmond's mask remains in place despite the assault. Small puncture holes, black with blood, acne the white cloth, the whole of which has turned pink and red. The contents inside the mask have lost their original shape. The borders of his face and skull rupture and are amorphous. His arms never once rise above his chest and shoulders to shield his head. His hands hang down to the tops of his thighs, and they flop and twitch as if attempting to break off and flee. His legs kick out and spasm, his shoes knocking a desperate SOS against the floor. Leonard circles behind Redmond, maneuvering between Adrian and Sabrina, mindful of their backswings. He waits and watches, politely waiting for a turn. He widens the distance between his hands on the weapon's thick handle. A stress crack, a fault line in the wood, runs down the length of what was once a sun-bleached boat oar. He lifts the sledgehammer end into the dusty sunbeam above them all. He yells and powers the hammer down in a looping, accelerating trajectory, splitting the space between Adrian and Sabrina. There's a tree snapping and falling crack and crunch. Redmond's sternum and ribcage collapse under the weight and force of the anvil-sized block of metal, which punches clear through to the spine. The violence of the impact vibration radiates across the floor and up the frame of Andrew's chair. A plume of red sprays the rope and Andrew's bare legs below the knee. The blood is warm on his skin. Red graffitis the jeans and white and off-white shirts of Sabrina and Leonard. Redmond's limbs cease fluttering. The fingers of his open, pleading hands close into his palms. Leonard retracts the sledgehammer and stumbles backward until he knocks into the couch. A crater in the middle of Redmond's chest fills with blood, and it has an absurd depth, perhaps stretching beyond the floor and into the basement. More blood pools beneath his body and flows away, dousing the cracks and grain of the hardwood floor. That his red shirt somehow remains fully buttoned and tucked into his jeans seems mocking and cruel. Jagged spears of bone peek through two of the gaps in the shirt between buttons. Wen hasn't moved from her spot next to Andrew, and still faces away from the carnage. Her odd breathing hasn't changed, though she mixes in a nearly inaudible high-pitched moan, or wheeze, like her throat and lungs are clogged. Her eyelashes brush against Andrew's ear when she blinks. He whispers, "I love you, Wen. Don't look. Don't turn around, okay?" Leonard drops the weapon, and it clatters heavily on the floor. He coughs through his closed mouth, puffing out his cheeks. He steps left, hesitates, and then steps back to the right, apparently unsure of where to go or what to do, until darting into the kitchen and throwing up into the sink. He turns the water on full blast, trying to drown out his puking. Adrian's face is blank, but it's a different kind of blank. She still has her weapon raised. The ends of the raking claws drip thick, syrupy blood. Color rushes into Sabrina's shocked face, making her cheeks ruddy, almost purple. She twists and tosses her weapon against the wood-burning stove. With her back to Andrew and the others, she folds her hands behind her neck, shakes her head, and talks to herself. Andrew can't hear what she says. Eric is slumped in his chair, eyes vacant and staring out to the deck and beyond. Andrew considers calling out his name and asking if he's okay. By the look of him, eyes glassy and in a half-squint, Eric might be better off being lost and hiding inside his own head. Andrew needs to regroup and focus on escaping from the chair. The ropes wrapped around his legs and wrists feel like they've tightened instead of loosening during his struggles. Leonard returns from the kitchen and stands at the head of Redmond's body. He wipes his mouth on his sleeve.
Adrian, can you help out here?
He sways, unsteady on his feet. The cabin is a boat pitching in rough seas. Adrian doesn't answer, and blankly stares at Redmond's corpse.
Adrian. Hey, Adrian.
She moves and talks in slow motion.
Hey. Yeah. What? I'm still here.
Help me take Redmond outside.
Adrian gently places her weapon on the floor behind her, only a step from the bathroom doorway. Leonard bends by Redmond's head and reaches out to dig his arms underneath the man's shoulders. Instead, he straightens and walks around the body to Redmond's feet. He is only inches away from Andrew. Andrew whispers, "Shh," to Wen, even though she isn't saying anything. He holds his breath, afraid that any sound or movement could trigger another frenzy of violence. Leonard says,
I'm going to, pull him outside, onto the deck there. Grab a bedspread or something so we can cover him up. And can you open the screen for me? Maybe pull that chair and end table out of the way, too?
Adrian whispers what Andrew thinks is, this is all so fucked. She slides the little end table deeper into the kitchen, the wooden legs complaining as they are dragged over the linoleum. She stands up the small lamp, straightening the yellow lampshade, and turns the switch on and off, 2, 3, 4 times and more. The little clicks don't result in any light.
Adrian?
Yeah, sorry.
She lifts back one of the remaining kitchen chairs and drops it in front of the refrigerator. Then she runs across the room into a bedroom and comes back out with a quilted and light and dark blue checkered bedspread, large enough to cover a wheat field. With the bedspread folded under her arm, Adrian kicks aside the balled-up curtain and slides open the screen to the deck, careful to keep it in the track. Leonard says,
You might have to take it off. I need as much space as you can give me to get through.
As Adrian walks onto the deck with the screen slider held out in front of her like a shield, Leonard picks up Redmond's feet. He tries tucking a leg under each of his arms, but it's an awkward hold, and the legs drop out and hit the floor with a wet splat. The earthy and iron-tinted smell of blood and piss intensifies with the disturbance of the body, as though the legs are bellows pumping out tainted air. Leonard grabs fistfuls of Redmond's jeans cuffed around the ankle. With the legs re-elevated, the smell further intensifies and he whispers,
Oh God,
and breathes loudly through his mouth. He spins the body 180 degrees so that the feet point to the deck. Leonard pauses and dry heaves once, dropping one leg to cover his mouth with the back of his hand. He says,
I'm okay, I got it.
And he grabs the leg again, continuing to talk to himself throughout the whole process. He pedals backward hastily, dragging the body behind him, leaving a smeared trail of blood on the floor. Redmond's masked head wobbles and shakes like an overfilled water balloon. Sabrina jogs into the bathroom and comes back out with an armload of towels. She sets the stack down on the floor to Andrew's right and spreads two towels, one is brown, the other a fraying and tattered Harry Potter towel featuring the cover of the first novel, over the blood on the floor. She stirs the towels around with her feet, half-heartedly mopping up the mess. Leonard is on the deck, and paused with Redmond's body half in and half out of the cabin. Hunched over, Leonard says,
"Watch out,"
to Adrian. He lunges backward, and the body goes with him, passing over the glass slider's metal tracking in the doorway and thunking down onto the deck. The wooden planks knock and echo with the body relocation effort until Leonard parks Redmond up against the banister railing opposite the doorway and past the picnic table. The body is not out of sight from the interior of the cabin. Leonard inspects his hands and his red-smeared shirt and pants, and then looks at his watch twice. The first peek is autonomic, a reflex. The second look lasts longer, and is a conscious attempt at determining the time. It occurs to Andrew that Leonard has been obsessively checking his watch ever since the four of them entered the cabin. Adrian covers the body with the blue blanket, tugging and pulling the corners over Redmond's legs. The blanket tents over his feet, and its extra length pools over his head and against the railing. Picking the screen slider back up, which has seen better days, the wire mesh is misshapen and sags near the corners of the warped frame. She speaks and gestures with motions of her head at the body, and then inside the cabin. Leonard says something, and he too points inside the cabin, and then he turns and walks away from both Adrian and the body. He pauses and says,
I don't want to look at him either.
As he ducks into the kitchen, the sunlight dies. How quickly it becomes dark inside the cabin alarms Andrew, and he can't help but imagine the light inside and outside continuing to dim until there is no light at all. Eric. Leonard stands in the same area of the common room where Eric saw whatever it was he thought he saw in the moments before the attack on Redmond. An amorphous image hovering in the air. A bas-relief made of light and outlined in more jagged light, which became a head and shoulders, then a full figure in a swirl of glint and glare. He wants to dismiss it as an illusion, a result or symptom of his injury. But in his memory, the figure animates before disappearing. It turns inexorably to face him. Did Andrew or Wen or any of the others see the figure too? No one reacted like they did. To Eric's right, Andrew shivers like he is freezing. Wen stands on Andrew's left, arms around his neck. She is in profile to Eric, facing the front door. Her eyes are open, and they don't blink often enough. Did Wen watch the death of Redmond? Eric can't remember if she was looking when Adrian first swung her weapon. Had she turned away before that? He thinks so. But he can't be sure. Did she see the figure made of light? Is she seeing it now in front of the door and staring back at her?
I'm truly sorry that had to happen and that you had to see it.
Leonard's voice wavers and has active fault lines. He stares at his hands, opens them, and closes them.
But we had no choice. We have no choice.
His apparent sincerity, or his sincere belief in his own words, is appalling and frightening. Eric believes for the first time that they will never leave this cabin alive, and prays silently. When there is no response to his apology and explanation, Leonard slumps and shuffles to the couch. He paws around the cushions and finds the remote control. He turns on the television, and Wen's Steven Universe winks back on, filling the blank screen on the wall. Eric recognizes the episode as having seen it before, but he does not remember what is going to happen next or later. Is it an episode he watched previously this summer? Or is it the same episode that was on earlier, before Leonard turned off the TV? Had everything happened in 15 minutes? 10 minutes? Less? Eric doesn't know. He doesn't know what time it is, or how long the four have been inside the cabin, and he can't remember when or how he was tied to his chair. He fears that he is forgetting other stuff, too, the most important stuff. Because of the concussion, he is also exhausted and is having trouble keeping his head up and eyes open. With her show back on, Wen turns around. She stands unnaturally straight and wooden, her body devoid of the kinetic energy with which she normally emanates. Her thumbs are again inside her fists and held against her mouth. Andrew says, "Wen, don't look outside." Wen shakes her head no. Eric isn't sure if the no is defiance or an agreement, or a meaningless automatic response. Sabrina carries the kitchen trash bin to the middle of the floor. She wipes her hands on her jeans as though her hands have already handled the towels and are covered in blood. She bends and lifts the sludgy, blood-soaked towels off the floor and drops them heavily into the bin, and two black flies spin into the air like whorls of smoke. With Redmond's body outdoors, and now the towels disposed of, the smell in the room improves enough that inhaling through his nose doesn't totally flip his stomach. The floor is still slick with blood. It'll never be clean again. Previously invisible gouges in the wood are angry slashes, scars that won't heal. Floorboards are tinted red in a trail leading to the deck. Taking the two remaining towels from the stack she brought out of the bathroom, Sabrina spreads them over the floor, end to end. She doesn't mop or push the towels around. They are left to be rugs. Then she covers the towels with the slider curtain. The flies briefly crawl on the curtain, and then flit away, disappointed. Leonard says, "I'm sorry, Wen, but I'm going to change the channel, okay? Just for a little bit, and then I'll put it back. I promise. You're doing so good, you know that? So brave. Your parents must be so proud." Andrew says, "Go fuck yourself." His voice goes from child who can't find his parents to full-on righteously angry Andrew in the span of three words. Leonard holds the remote close to his face, his hands trembling. He pauses the show with Steven Universe smiling, his plump fist raised triumphantly above his head. Eric looks outside at the shaded deck and the covered body against the railing. A strong breeze ripples through the folds and edges of the checkered blue cloth. That charmingly homey and homely bedspread was half of an apartment warming gift from his parents when he and Andrew moved in together more than 15 years ago. The other half of the apartment warming gift wasn't quite as charming. A golden framed placard that read, "God bless this home and all who enter," writ in a looping Gothic script above prayer hands pressed together. Eric couldn't decide if the framed blessing was a writer, a parental compromise between no gift and gift. Eric wasn't opposed to the blessing's sentiment, as tacky as its presentation was. But Andrew ranted, like only the deeply offended could. He and Andrew tossed the placard and repurposed the frame. Eric insisted on keeping and using the bedspread for their guest room, should his parents visit and stay over. Mom and Dad never set foot in their first apartment. They made their maiden visit to Cambridge and the condo shortly after they adopted Wen, and in the years since, they have visited four more times. For those keeping score, Andrew's parents drive down from Vermont to visit once every 2 months. Eric keeps score. His mom and dad have yet to sleep in the condo's guest room and have instead stayed in a hotel, insisting they didn't want to be a bother, didn't want to get in the way. Mom said it so warmly and with such regret, Eric believed it to be true. While Mom acted as spokesperson, Dad would break off eye contact, slump his shoulders and drop his head like a scolded dog, only now reminded of a bad deed, but one he doesn't regret. It was like watching Dad, this graying and diminishing version of the man who was once as big and strong as Paul Bunyan, remember he wasn't supposed to be enjoying himself in their company as much as he was. Andrew once asked Eric what he was thinking as he stood at the bay window while his parents left the building and ducked into an idling cab 2 stories below. Eric said, "I'm happy and proud they're here." He paused, and Andrew hugged him from behind. "And I'm sad, infinitely sad." Eric lifts his drooped head and swims up from the warm waters of reverie. Did he fall asleep or pass out? And for how long was he out? He looks around the cabin nervously, and everyone seems to be in the same place they were moments before. He blurts out, "Let's stop this now, right? We can get you help. We can, I promise. Let us go and we can get you help. Nothing more has to happen. It can end now. You can end it now." Eric sighs at himself. He doesn't mean it the way it might sound to them. He shouldn't be using the words "end it now." Leonard impatiently shakes his head, brushing Eric off. He looks at his wristwatch and says, "Please watch the TV. It'll be on soon." The screen blips over to a cable news network. It's some mid-afternoon business talking head kind of show, according to the guide bar at the bottom of the screen. Instead of news, a supplemental health coverage commercial for seniors is being broadcast. The pitch comes from a one-time famous actress who speaks plaintively into the camera. Andrew asks, "What will be on soon?" "What you need to see." "Is it your favorite show? You just can't miss it, right? I've seen you check your watch every 5 minutes since you broke into our cabin." "Well, it must be a great show. I know I can't wait. What's it rated? We don't let Wen just watch anything, you know? Maybe you should have set the DVR." Andrew is pushing too hard and gearing up to push harder. Eric says, "Okay, okay, easy, Andrew." Eric appreciates that Andrew hasn't shut down and isn't giving up talking them out of this, but Christ, they bludgeoned one of their own to death, an act that is as confounding as it is horrifying. What is clear to Eric is the level of violence to which they've committed will not be verbally wise-assed away. Perhaps Andrew senses a weakening or flagging of their will to see whatever this is through, given how obviously shaken they are in the aftermath of Redmond's ritualized attack and death. Eric doesn't see it. He sees zealots, fully engaged with their cause. Further, their squeamishness likely means it'll be easier for them to abdicate any sense of personal responsibility and continue to attribute their actions to the as-of-yet unattributed source of their professed apocalyptic visions and murderous commands. Unbidden and unwanted, questions from a corner in a forgotten chamber inside Eric's head.
"Did they see the same figure of light I saw? Have they seen it before they came here to us? Did they see it when they closed their eyes, when they dreamed their Armageddon dreams?"
2 more commercials run. One is for a cleaning product that cannot be purchased in stores, and the other is a seizure-inducing promo for the network's primetime political roundtable. Everyone in the cabin remains quiet throughout the inanity of shouted slogans and loud exclamations, as though this is their very own sponsored intermission. The news program returns with a blizzard of garish color that hurts Eric's head. The infinite news ticker at the bottom of the screen scrolls by with blurry data blips about refugees, unemployment, the death of a beloved celebrity, and the Dow Jones average being down. Breaking news, in large red font, bullies the main screen, overlaying the red, white, and blue adorned newsroom. A finely pressed newscaster, in a finely pressed suit, stands in the lower right corner of the screen. He gravely welcomes everyone back for their continuing coverage of a 7.9 magnitude earthquake centered in the Aleutian Islands, which struck more than 4 hours ago. The Aleutians are a chain of volcanic islands stretching across the Bering Sea, with some of the islands belonging to both Alaska and, at its western extremes, Russia. Eric and Andrew researched booking an Alaskan cruise that would navigate by some of the larger islands, but they gave up when the opportunity to adopt a child materialized quicker than they'd planned. The U.S. National Tsunami Warning Center has issued a cautionary advisory to British Columbia, Canada, and over 1,000 miles of coast along the American Pacific Northwest, including the cities of Seattle and Portland. However, the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center issued its strongest warning to the islands of Hawaii. Residents and tourists on the north-facing coastlines are under a mandatory evacuation order and are to seek higher ground immediately. Andrew says, "Is this what we're supposed to see?" "It is. You don't get it yet." "No, I don't." "I explained to all of you that if you didn't choose to make a sacrifice, the oceans will rise and cities will drown. I used those exact words. The cities will drown." Leonard slowly and loudly enunciates and points at the television. His patient tone and calm demeanor he employs whenever addressing Andrew, Wen, or Eric cracks, and anger oozes out. Or is it panic? It's difficult to tell the difference. "You remember me telling you that, right? You said you understood what I was telling you." Eric vaguely recalls Leonard saying something about drowning cities, along with the list of other threats. But he doesn't remember them. Andrew says, "Yes, I remember, but this doesn't mean anything. This, no, no more." He points the remote control at Andrew. "I've been very patient with you, but now you have to watch and listen." Leonard closes his eyes, shakes his head, and shrugs his shoulders, as if to say, "I'm trying my best to make everything go smoothly." He points at the TV again. "I shouldn't yell. I know you're scared of me, of us, but please, watch." The network cuts to an interviewer and interviewee, digitally separated on the screen. The woman on the right is a spokesperson for the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center. She explains that there are nearly 24 tsunami detection buoys in the northern Pacific, with a cluster tracing the perimeter of the northern Ring of Fire, which is only 100 miles or so from the epicenter of this earthquake. The data they've received points to a sizable wave of 15 to 20 feet in height, headed south toward the Hawaiian Islands. The newscaster cuts in to announce that a tsunami has made landfall. As the audio of the interview continues, its video is banished to the lower right corner. A feed from a beach resort on the Hawaiian island of Kauai fills the center of the screen. It's unclear if this is live or taped. In Hawaii, it's a bright, beautiful day. Small tufts of clouds are afterthoughts in the wide sky. The sand is golden, and the palm leaves are green. The hotel pool is crystal blue and empty. The resort has already been evacuated. A swell of water, gray with foam and sand, speckled with dark soil, palm fronds, and other debris, rushes up the length of the beach, overwhelms the pool and courtyard, swallowing chairs and tables, pushing into cabanas and the hotel's lower-level rooms. The channel cuts to other videos from smaller towns and from the less traveled and populated northwestern or leeward islands. The greedy waves capsize small boats, swamp marinas, wipe out decks and docks, and wash out seaside roads. While acknowledging beach erosion and the damage to property will be extensive, the spokesperson talks about the success of their early warning detection system, as they had plenty of lead time to evacuate the coasts and low-lying areas of the affected Hawaiian Islands. It's early, but no injuries or fatalities have been reported. Andrew says, "Hey," Eric interrupts with, "Don't. Just don't." Because he knows what Andrew wants to say, is going to say. Andrew grits his teeth, shakes the hair out of his eyes, and says it anyway. "This is some doomsday you have going there, so how about you let us go now?" Leonard doesn't respond. "Let Eric and Wen go, at least. I'll stay and we can discuss apocalyptic themes and cultural traumas of the 21st century all you want. Just let them go." Adrian hurries into the bathroom, shuts the door, and turns the sink on full blast. There are lower sounds buried under the rush of water. Eric can't tell if she's crying and or talking to herself. Sabrina says, "I don't understand. This isn't..." She stops in mid-sentence, walks over to Leonard's side of the room, and taps his arm. "Leonard?" "I know, but keep watching. We're supposed to keep watching." Eric says, "How long?" "Until we see what we're supposed to see. Until we see what was shown to us." Leonard sounds unsure, even desperate. He chances a quick look at Eric, and then Andrew, before intently staring at the TV again, willing it to play the images in his head, whatever they are. The station replays the flooding of the resort, which is the most dramatic footage to have aired. The talking heads repeat the same numbers and timelines. Eric is about to ask if they can change the channel back to a show for when. When there's a rough cut away from the various Hawaiian video feeds to the lead broadcaster. He doesn't say anything and has a finger in his ear. He doesn't know he's on air. He recovers and announces that a second massive earthquake has struck in the Pacific, registering at 8.6 on the Richter scale. The epicenter is only 70 miles off the coast of Oregon, in what's called the Cascadia Subduction Zone, an area scientists have long feared would produce a catastrophic earthquake. Leonard shouts, "This is it! This is it!" He turns, and for a moment, he has an "I got exactly what I wanted for my birthday" smile on his face, which quickly landslides into the pained look of a reluctant witness. "You didn't stop it from happening, and you could have. You were supposed to make a sacrifice. When you didn't, we were forced to make one for you, and now, the consequences. You could have stopped this." Sabrina is standing and facing the TV. She says, "No, no, no." Adrian explodes out of the bathroom, her face red and dripping wet. "It's happening? Is it really fucking happening? Oh, Jesus, God." Leonard continues talking to Eric, Andrew, and Wen, but he watches the screen. His eyes shimmer with tears. He says, "I'm sorry. That's not fair of me. Of course I mean to say we, not you. We could have stopped it, but we didn't. We failed. We are in this together, all of us. I'm sorry. This is hard. This is impossible. I keep saying that, but it's true. And we didn't stop this. We're too late." Sabrina, Adrian, and Leonard talk, and they ask questions. Some are rhetorical, and some are impossible to answer. They share reactions, looks, and nods of support, nonverbal confirmation that what is happening on the rectangular 1-inch-thick screen is real. Eric strains to block them out and hear what is being said on the news, but the cabin is all shouts and exclamations, everything muddying in the echo chamber of his throbbing head. The room pauses to take a collective breath, long enough for one of the seismologists to posit the earthquake in the Aleutian Islands triggered this second quake, which lasted for